Hello there, listeners. It's Susie Noo from the Australian Society of Anaesthetists, and thank you for listening to our podcast. It's called Australian Anaesthesia, and it's where we talk about all things relevant to anaesthesia in Australia. This episode comes with a trigger warning. This conversation was hard for me to record and might be hard for some of you out there to listen to. I'm talking with Dr. Ben McKenzie, an emergency physician. His son died from anaphylaxis in a Melbourne hospital. Dr. McKenzie was also involved in the resuscitation of his own son. And I also happened to drop some swear words. If you're not here for this episode, I get it. But I do ask one favour before you go. If you work in a critical care environment, then I ask you, actually, I beg you, to look at Ben's website. It's amax4.com. His son's name was Max. There is a link to the website in the show notes, and it's where you can learn about why, how, and most importantly, when to resuscitate people so that we can work together and prevent brain injury due to hypoxic arrest. As I said, Ben is an emergency physician. He's also one of the kindest people I have ever met and so very humble. He was the director of emergency training for many years where he worked and so is well placed to teach us about this. It's so sad and tragic that it had to come about this way. This episode is dedicated to Max. Are you ready? Let's go for it. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. How are you? It's been a long time. Long time no see.
I know.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. And I think we crossed paths at ARV briefly there for a while. Are you still there or are you?
I haven't been back since Max died because that's actually where I was when it all unfolded. And so I actually went by lights and sirens in my ambulance uniform, which is how it all unfolded that I ended up becoming a team leader because I had my uniform on and they just
assumed you were, oh God.
Yeah. So that's how it happened.
Oh dear. Anyway, I still remember you because we were at med school together.
Yeah.
And have you heard of this thing called a lollipop moment? I'll send you the YouTube link for it, but it's basically this cute story about this guy handing out lollipops. It was like someone's first day at university and they were nervous as hell. They didn't really want to go and they almost didn't, but they did. They rocked up and I think their parents were with them. And this guy, this big goofy guy comes down and he's making jokes and handing out lollipops and says something silly. And anyway, she contacts him years later and she goes, "You don't have any idea who I am, but you handed me this lollipop while I was waiting." And he handed it to the guy behind me and he and I are now married and I finished my degree and I almost never went to university. And I just want to thank you for handing out that lollipop. So I have a lollipop moment for you.
Oh, really?
Which is, you probably don't remember it. I'm sure you wouldn't. We were at university and, you know, because we both came from Canberra.
Yeah, that's right. Oh my God, that's time to come back to me.
Yeah. And this is kind of coming around full circle because I came from Canberra. I came from not a wealthy background, a co-ed school, government school. And I think I was just having one of those moments where I just wasn't quite sure that I was fitting into university in Melbourne and all that sort of stuff. And I must have told you beforehand we'd had this connection over Canberra, like we just remember now. And you came up to me and you said something. You remembered that we were both from Canberra. And here we were, these sort of skinny, pimply kids. And I was like,
"Yeah,
you actually remembered. You actually took the time to remember that I was from Canberra and we had that in common. And I had a better sense of belonging to university that day. So thank you."
That's cool. I'm glad that helped.
And how far we've come from those kids to bed.
Oh my God, it seems like a lifetime ago. But also just like yesterday, it's kind of crazy. The sense of passage of time is a peculiar thing. You can look at it in one way and it's fast and then in another way and it was forever ago.
Yeah, true. All right. I thought I would take us through today, if that's okay with you.
Yeah. What sort of content do you want to cover?
What I thought we'd do is what's a classic hero arc kind of story. So I wanted to start with what you were up to, what you were doing before Max died, what life was like, and then go through talking about Max and the events and then just the amazing work that you're doing now. Does that sound all right?
Yeah, sure.
And if at any time you need time out, please just let me know.
Yeah, no problems. That sounds good.
And I might need time out too because I find this very, very hard to talk about.
Yeah, it's a pretty unusual story. You couldn't really script it, I don't think.
Yeah. I agree. I'm so grateful for you giving up time today to have a chat with me about this. But let's just time out on it if and when we need.
Sounds good, Susie.
All right. So as we were talking, we went to Melbourne University together. Since university, you went on and became an emergency physician.
Yes.
And we've crossed paths at adult retrieval, doing a bit of retrieval work. And what else were you doing? What other clinical work or non-clinical work as well?
Yeah, so I was interested in emergency medicine right from internship, and that's where I stayed. I first became a registrar at the Northern, and then my first consultant job was in Geelong, and then all my extended family's from Bendigo, and I felt drawn to all the positives of working in a mixed emergency department where you see kids and adults together and there's no big hospital just next door. You've sort of got to be able to handle any emergency. And there was a bunch of friends where we all decided that we would commute to Bendigo. So a couple of us lived in Bendigo, but a lot of us were commuting from Melbourne, and we spent a decade setting Bendigo up to be a really great academic emergency medicine centre. And it's now the regional centre with the most emergency medicine trainees outside Melbourne. In fact, it's got more than the rest of Victoria combined.
Wow, that's great building of a service there.
Yeah, so that's what I did. And in a smaller place, you get to try lots of different jobs, like being a divisional director of different services and becoming acting chief medical officer. And that was kind of interesting. But, clinical medicine was always my passion. And after a decade of commuting to Bendigo, I decided to, the kids are growing up really quickly and I wanted to spend more time with them. And so instead of doing my late early commutes and spending time up that way, I decided to follow people I admire and ended up taking a contract at the Royal Melbourne, even though they don't see kids. It was closer to home and I liked the bunch of people to work with. But Just as I was seeing out my notice period at Bendigo, that's when my life fell apart.
Oh, gosh. At your notice period at Royal Melbourne or at Bendigo?
At Bendigo, and just doing all my orientation and signing all the paperwork for Royal Melbourne. So I was literally between jobs when things happened.
Gosh. So you hadn't started at Royal Melbourne yet?
Hadn't started at Royal Melbourne.
Oh, my God.
But I'd given my notice and resigned from Bendigo.
Oh, right. Literally, I see. Literally between jobs. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And doing some work at Adult Retrieval Victoria.
Yeah. So I've done retrieval medicine for my entire consultant career. And that's always been a fun job because you get to work with intensivists and anaesthetists as colleagues and doing the same work together and having a slightly different angle on the same case, and it's a really great way to learn and share experience.
Agreed. Yeah. I really liked my time at ARV. And home is in Melbourne?
Is in Melbourne, yep.
Yeah. And you and your wife and
three kids.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, so we have three children. The oldest is Max. The middle one's Ella and the younger one's Lucy. They're all best friends, but Max died from anaphylaxis when he was 15.
Oh, that was about 20 months ago or so, was it?
Yep, 20 months ago, yeah.
So we're talking, it's 2023 now. I know you'll know the date exactly in your mind. We're talking
It's the 19th of August 2021. But it was actually the 6th of August when Max had anaphylaxis, but he didn't die until 13 days later.
Right. And so Melbourne at that time is in or out of lockdown, and it's all a bit crazy.
Yeah, so it was actually the day Max had anaphylaxis was day one of lockdown number 5, the last lockdown. Right.
So there's all that kind of craziness about who can come into health services and
Yeah, everyone was immunised, all the healthcare workers were immunised by that point. It'd been going for 18 months, I think. The system had got used to it to a certain extent.
Okay. So I won't preempt you with questions except to say, tell us what happened.
So Max had finished school play rehearsals late the night before, and he often stayed at his grandma's house and begged to stay at his grandma's house that night because they was around the corner from school, and so we thought that was all reasonable. And I was working the next day at AIV. We had a conversation about getting his kayak from the boat club near us on the Yarra so he could paddle during lockdown number 5, because that was allowed then. And that was the last conversation I had with him, and I went down and got his kayak out and brought it home. And then the next day I went to work at ARV, and it was a fairly uneventful day. And you know, as with all of these lockdowns, it tended to be quiet in the medical world when the lockdowns were called. Well, you know, elective theatre's being cancelled or at least reduced. And then there's emergencies kind of empty because everyone's at home. And Max accidentally ate some dessert, some catering that had come home because there'd been a workshop that had been cancelled for his grandma, and he ate this apple crumble, which turned out to have walnuts in it. And he started to get itchy, and then he vomited, and at that point called my wife, Tamara, to Max's mum, Tamara, and she was actually just around the corner about to pick him up. And so she arrived.
So still at his grandma's house at this point. And he stayed there the night before.
And so Tamara arrived, and Max looked like he had symptoms of asthma, and he was itchy, and they all realised it was anaphylaxis, and Max gave himself his EpiPen. Tamara called 000, and they really did everything right within minutes of things unfolding. So this is in metropolitan Melbourne, surrounded by hospitals and with an ambulance service that is not stretched. It's, you know, it's lockdown day number one. And the system isn't under pressure yet. 15-year-old boy ends up dying from anaphylaxis in that setting. So he was 10 minutes drive. So if you Google Maps it, 10 minutes drive to the nearest hospital by private vehicle.
And I want to refer people, first of all, straight away, because I've watched all your educational videos, which I think are fantastic, and you go through it there. So I always think if we don't discuss anything here, they can go watch it on the videos. You've had the hard conversation. So I just want to flag that so we don't have to feel like we have to go through everything here. You're at ARV. How did you find out about it?
So Tamara called me and let me know what was going on. And I made arrangements to start to leave. And, you know, I'm always the person who will just finish that last couple of phone calls and not leave it to somebody else. So I did that. But then I started getting messages from Tamara saying that there was a Micah intensive care paramedic arrived, and the paramedic manager at ARV said, don't worry, that's just standard protocol, which it's not, but tried to reassure me. And then I realised I needed to leave, and so made arrangements to leave. And as I left, I got a text message from Tamara saying he's peri-arrest. And so I went back inside and said I need to get to the hospital, and there was a light duties paramedic who drove me, lights and sirens, from ARV to the hospital.
That's good of them to do that.
I'm not sure if it was supposed to happen like that, but in the heat of the moment, that's what happened, and that was a good thing.
Is Tamara medical as well? Or health?
No, she's an optometrist, so she's health. She's been doing health policy and working in optometry and health policy for the last decade. Yeah,
but she could recognise that Max was peri-arrest.
No, she was in the ambulance,
right?
And that's what the paramedics were saying to the hospital on the radio.
Right. So she picked up on that and relayed it to you, pronto.
Yeah, And it was also in the context of Max's last words saying, I'm going to die. And Tamara being him saying that in the back of the ambulance as they're driving and her sitting in the front seat having to listen to that.
Oh, God, awful. So
I'm in Port Melbourne and it's quite a drive to the hospital and Max is on the way to hospital and he's become unconscious and peri arrest and and they arrived there within minutes, but yet I'm the one that ended up having to facilitate a number of interventions that were life-saving but too late. So it felt like a long way, that ambulance trip.
I bet. I just, when I first heard what happened, through every critical care physician, send chills up and down their spine. I mean, I remember when I've got a now 6-year-old, but I remember when my daughter was young and, you know, when they first start solids and they're choking occasionally. And I remember one night thinking, well, that's okay. I've got some pediatric laryngoscopes because of my work in developing countries. I take them overseas. But then I thought, what's that going to do? I don't have tubes. I don't have a McGill's. Like, that is false reassurance. But it's just something that you think, I never want to be in that position.
That's so funny you say that because we travelled all over the world with Max and his nut allergy because he was diagnosed from when he was a toddler. And we went to Morocco into the desert on a camel and I had laryngoscopes and a tube and fluids and adrenaline and I had the whole kit, yet we came undone in metropolitan Melbourne.
I'm going to ask a question more for me than you, I think, which is, are you angry about this?
Yeah, so I sent an email to, there's sort of like a distribution list with emergency physicians on it, and I said, what's my response supposed to be? Is it to just go away and grieve an unimaginable loss? Is it to forgive? Is it to be angry? But, you know, something that we're never going to forget, even if you do forgive and that's the path that you choose, or is it to actually try and fix it? And I think, I mean, incredibly angry. So the anger is actually not so much at the individuals involved, but I'm angry that a culture of critical care can develop where that kind of, well, a slow response to a time-critical child who's not breathing in front of you is so slow and disorganized and chaotic. And I'm angry that that can exist because it doesn't exist in Bendigo and it doesn't exist at the Royal Melbourne. And it doesn't exist in a lot of places, but it existed for Max on that day. And then the hospital told us that that care was best practice and did so and had to be prompted a number of times by Safer Care Victoria and to engage in a review that eventually found that it wasn't best practice, but that the anger is directed there in that people not wanting to have the best, not strive for excellence and to be as good, to have a standard of care that's, doesn't matter which hospital you go to, whether it's the kids or some tertiary quaternary hospital versus a regional hospital, you should get the same response from critical care clinicians. And that makes me very angry to think that doesn't happen because we all have the capabilities to provide that.
It's like they missed their learning opportunity.
Yeah, and over a number of years have sort of slid into this sort of zone where maybe the case mix isn't particularly acute and so there's just not this interest in critical care or doing things well, and so the morbidity and mortality review is like, oh, there's nothing to see here. So... yeah, kind of. That's the bit that I'm most angry at.
Because
the system didn't support the individuals. The culture at the hospital wasn't, we do it, we nail this situation.
Yeah.
Like you would in theatre.
Yeah.
Like you would anywhere where critical care clinicians are, you know, trying to save somebody's life. So that's the bit that makes me the most angry.
I bet. Is there any further action, just in case? I don't want to land you in hot water.
So the coronial investigation is still ongoing, but you're allowed to talk about whatever you want with a coronial investigation. Yeah, so journalists are allowed to talk about it. We're allowed to talk about it.
You make an interesting point about that comment about what we do in theatre.
Yeah.
You know, and I recently had an experience, a classic one. Every anaesthetist has had this. Induce, LMA goes in. Can't ventilate. Try again, maybe different LMA, different size, try again, can't ventilate. And you think, oh, is this a severe bronchospasm? Is this the LMA not fitting? And his sats are starting to go down. And I remember at this point, my first gut reaction is got to intubate. But then my next reaction, interestingly, which is one that I probably wouldn't have had earlier in my career, was, oh, but the sats are not that great. I should pre-oxygenate this patient further and get their sats up again. And I think this is what happens as you advance in your career and your scope, your practice scope gets narrower as an anaesthetist. We're used to anaesthetizing fit, healthy patients that tend to have LMAs. And we move away from that critical care environment. And our gut instinct to just get on and intubate can sometimes be thrown.
Well, it's great that your gut told was right.
All that time at ARV.
That's fantastic. And I guess when I think about anaesthetists and where you might be faced with anaphylaxis, it's either intraoperatively, there's, I guess, the recovery scenario, and then there's places outside the theatre complex, like going to emergency to be part of a code blue team perhaps, or maybe somewhere else in the hospital. But the principles are all the same, but it's hard to extrapolate that same gut reflex that you had to put the tube down to a scenario where it's not your environment, but the same priority exists, and trying to get people on the same page. And that's the whole, I guess, idea of what I'm trying to do. So there's a common language to recognize the problems, particularly of bronchospasm and airway compromise that happen with anaphylaxis. And so that if you and I, Susie, have to do an anaphylaxis together someday, that we're like, yeah, no, we're putting the tube down. Mm-hmm. And that's the first thing that's happened. And if we can't do that, then we're going to make it happen either orally or surgically. It's just that's what we do, and we're going to do it before hypoxic brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the whole concept of my website and the AMAX4 algorithm, is to try and have some just simple prompt to get people to follow their gut or do what they know is right, but do it in a timely manner, because none of the concepts are new that I present. It's all the same stuff, like APLS drug doses.
Mm.
It's just stuff that you do in theatre. It's the same as the ANSCA action cards. It's just putting it in a really simple format, which is give some adrenaline, get an airway that's got a cuff, so your airway is protected from laryngeal edema, and that you've got a working cuff that's going to be able to provide enough pressure to ventilate someone with sudden severe bronchospasms.
I agree. I'll come back to AMAX4 in a bit because I think it's amazing. But I wanted to just touch on something that you mentioned in, I think, your first video that you have on your website, which is a similar incident occurred, was it 10 or 15 days before Max?
It was 8 weeks before Max.
Okay.
But only 8 weeks, and it was very identical. In that case, his name's James Sindos, and they're a lovely family, and they're close to us. And I certainly have permission to talk about James. So James is slightly different in that his deterioration happened about over the same time frame, but that he arrived at hospital before he had his respiratory compromise and respiratory arrest. And so his deterioration was wholly within the emergency department. And yet the same things happened. In there was failure to recognize bronchospasm as the main issue. And in fact, James's pleas for help while he was short of breath were thought to be anxiety, which is reported in the literature as a thing that people try and do with asthmatics who are asking for help. But in both cases, both boys asked for help and knew what was about to happen. They both said, they both literally said the words, "I'm going to die."
Oh, gosh.
So they shared that commonality, yet the healthcare response didn't meet their urgency and their pleas for help, which I think is, you know, when someone's clearly stating the problem and telling you that you need to fix it and not to be able to have the response to meet their needs in healthcare, I think is a real problem.
Agreed.
And yeah.
And I think knowing what happened to James, did that just give you more motivation to try and fix this, to let's change our thinking around this?
Absolutely. The Syndoses have given us strength to be able to go forwards when we're feeling down, and likewise we've supported them when they feel they can't go on. I mean, it demonstrates that there's a problem, but it's not confined to these two cases. And it's fascinating that I'm at the moment just doing a systematic review and going through my ethics application to interrogate the National Coronial Information System, but the data's already there, and almost all young people who die from anaphylaxis die from the bronchospasm component. And we kind of know that it needs to be fixed and it's there in all the algorithms, but people don't realise that it can be just extreme, and we see so much anaphylaxis that we can get through and manage and it's okay, but sometimes it's fulminant, and it tends to be people with a history of wheeze or asthma because their airways are more reactive, and so they get fulminant bronchospasm that requires really aggressive treatment, and it's difficult, no doubt, but people tend to get there and provide the care, but they just do it in a really slow way. So these three young people, you know, 15, 17, 22, they all die from a hypoxic injury in the Australian healthcare system because we're slow at our jobs, or we have people who are working in a culture or a system that doesn't support them, or just not doing what most of us would do. So we need to help those of us who feel uncomfortable in that situation, because we all feel uncomfortable, but we need something to help us be able to do the things we need to do before the hypoxic brain injury, which is a really short time.
And that's where AMAX4 comes in.
Yeah.
Which is a lovely, lovely algorithm.
It's mainly about the four. You know, I say in my lecture, it doesn't have to be Max's name. It just happens that maximum or max is a good limiting kind of word, and it's about the 4 minutes. And we know that brains die very quickly, and in cardiac arrest, we try and extend the time to brain injury by doing CPR, and that kind of works when it's not a hypoxic arrest. But in an asphyxic hypoxic arrest, you can't extend the time with CPR until you fix the A and the B and the oxygen levels, because that's why they've arrested. So CPR is kind of pointless. You're just circulating deoxygenated blood, and so you need to rapidly fix the airway and breathing, which is a tube with a working cuff. And we know from animal studies that 4 minutes is all it takes. We know from recurrent healthcare tragedies that 4 minutes is all it takes. And if you want to extrapolate a real-life clinical scenario, then there's a good meta-analysis of immersion times in drowning. And if your immersion time is longer than 5 minutes, then you're almost certainly going to have a neurological deficit and outcome. So, and that's real world data looking at immersion times. So there's plenty of data to say it's 4 minutes, whether it's animal or experimental or anecdotal or case series in drowning, it's there. And it's just that it doesn't hit you in the face. They're often got high dose adrenaline. So if you give someone high dose adrenaline, their vasoconstricted and you can't get the SATs monitoring, and you sort of don't have the normal cues. So it's just a reflex when you find yourself that you can't record the SATs or there's bradycardia in the setting of hypoxia, that your reflex is just maximum 4 minutes, and that's adrenaline in a tube. So AMAX4 stands for adrenaline. That can be 1 microgram per kilo IV as per APLS, or a cardiac arrest dose, and then muscle relaxant, because you only want to have one attempt at putting the tube in, because that'll take you 4 minutes by the time you've done all of this. And then you put the ETT in orally with your one best attempt, and then if that doesn't work out, it's a surgical airway. And the X is just for all the extras that come after that. Because even once you've got the tube in, this is one scenario where you, oh, the tube's in, you can relax. It's not like that. There's lots of clinical scenarios where once the tube's in, everyone's, oh, phew, oh, the tube's in. But this is one where you have to keep going, putting the tube in is just the first step, and then you need extra bronchodilators and vasopressors and some extreme obstructive ventilation.
Absolutely. There's that terrible moment when you intubate someone with severe bronchospasm that you don't get any CO2 back. And everyone doubts, including yourself especially, you doubt whether you've got the tube in the right place, and it's just that the lungs are so stiff, there is no CO2 coming back for those first few puffs.
Yep. Yeah, totally. And that's a recognised problem. And anaesthetists are aware of this more than anybody else, and I think it's a really good point to highlight, because of course there was that high profile case in the UK where they thought it was anaphylaxis and weren't sure about the CO2 trace, but it was an esophageal intubation. So it should feel tight, right?
Yeah.
Like you've got also got that cue that it's hard and you can't deliver nothing, even though the pressures are 50 to 100, you need to deliver some sort of tidal volume.
Exactly. And you can always have a look back in with a video laryngoscope just to double check.
Yeah. You guys are the experts at putting airways in and making sure they're in the right spot.
We just have to pull the trigger to do it, don't we?
Yeah, that's it.
That's the thing. I liked that in your lecture, you make that really important physiological point about the difference in PaO2 between a cardiac arrest and a respiratory arrest.
Yeah.
I think once you understand and know that physiology, then you know that the treatment has got to be different.
Yeah, that's right. So classical VF, you start off with normal oxygen saturations and suddenly have VF. And of course you can have VF because you're sick and in other circumstances, mm-hmm. but that's the classical scenario and that's what the algorithm's designed for. The 30-2 and focus on chest compressions is an absolutely wonderful life-saving algorithm, but really focused on VF and all the non-shockable rhythms really need something else to be fixed. And CPR may or may not help or may not cause harm while you're doing those other things. So in a hypoxic arrest, the scenario is you're tachycardic because you're dying and then you suddenly become so hypoxic that your coronary arteries aren't getting any oxygen and your myocardium's not getting oxygen and you brady out. And that is in itself should be the trigger to say brain injury is about to happen within a couple of minutes here. But just exactly as you say, we need to be sophisticated in the way that we apply cardiac arrest algorithms.
Absolutely. I'm an ALS instructor, but I'm also a pediatric resuscitation instructor. And I think part of the way this happens is ALS has done too well in teaching people to start compressions immediately, you know, minimize time that you're not doing compressions, and LMA is okay. They've really gotten that message out there. But it is the opposite when we're talking about pediatric arrests, because pediatric arrests more commonly are hypoxic.
Absolutely.
And we need to just get that message out there as efficiently and effectively as the ALS minimise time that you're not doing compression message.
Absolutely. And I've certainly written to the Australian Resuscitation Council to say that there needs to be a special circumstance algorithm for anaphylaxis and for arrested asthma, because it really does depend on that working cuff to be able to deliver the pressure that you need and to protect the airway. And yeah, hopefully they'll be responsive. And that's usually the first question I get whenever I do my talk in real life is, when is the algorithm changing? And I say, oh, I'm working on it. I'm doing a PhD to try and convince everybody, or at least, you know, find the evidence, because there is some evidence there. And yeah, it's a really important point.
It's incredible. You're doing AMAX4. You've got a great website. You've got a great series of lectures on there, which I encourage everyone to go and watch. You're doing a PhD.
Yeah, the PhD. My topic is a novel approach to resuscitation in anaphylaxis and asthma. You know, it's about finding the data. One, it's about establishing the data that bronchospasm is the main mechanism for death in young people. I appreciate that anaesthetists have got this cohort of older people who have got compromised physiology and ASA 3 and 4, and anaphylaxis in that scenario is a disaster, and that it is true that age is the biggest risk factor for drug-related anaphylaxis. Then the next part of my PhD is really trying to match cohorts of people who survive versus people who die and the interventions that each group gets and whether there's a meaningful difference in time to intubation and time to treatment, because that's the novel part of this algorithm, is that there's a time embedded into the algorithm. And I think that's a really important cognitive aid, and it would be nice to see if there is that data to support it, because it kind of makes sense from a parachute physiology, proving that a parachute works.
Mm.
Yep, your terminal velocity with a parachute on and off are very different, and it's the kind of same principles that we're trying to prove here. And do we need data? Possibly not, but I think it's easier to convince people and bring people along for the ride when there is some science behind it.
Well, I think it already makes intuitive sense, and I think there already is good science behind it, but I do appreciate and I do look forward to seeing what your PhD shows.
Yeah. Thank you.
I think it's incredible that you're taking on a PhD and you're getting out there and spreading the good word about AMAX4. What else? What else are you also working on?
Part of the reason I am doing my PhD is to link the silos of allergists and critical care clinicians, because in anaesthesia, you've actually got a really good group of people who are interested in allergy and anaesthetic-related anaphylaxis.
Mm.
And that's awesome. The same doesn't exist in intensive care or emergency. In emergency, we see mostly food allergies. That's the most common cause, as well as some drug and some venom related. So it is a different cohort to what anaesthetists see with drug-related anaphylaxis. So maybe those differences are useful to understand when you come to ED, and maybe it's food, and it's almost certainly going to be bronchospasm that the reason why the young person is unconscious. But also the allergists, when you look at all anaphylaxis algorithms around the world, it's fascinating how much input that they have. And when they're treating a small amount of anaphylaxis, and usually in a desensitization clinic where there's small doses, whereas we're seeing all the uncontrolled catastrophic ones, and really trying to meet each other and share ideas and say that we're both seeing the same group of patients, and we're trying to build a shared understanding so that recommendations they make mean something to us. And when we're sending patients off to see them for desensitization or drug allergy assessment, that our referrals mean something to them. So that's part of my mission as well.
That's a great, great body of work. I just did a podcast with the chair of ANZAG, which is the Australian New Zealand Anaesthetic Allergy Group. And so, yes, that group exists for anaesthetic allergy.
It's wonderful that it exists.
Exactly.
And it's a credit to the craft and the profession, and the same needs to develop in other fields.
Yeah, the more people who are involved in caring for people with anaphylaxis having input together, the better, and hopefully these situations can be avoided in the future.
Yeah, so my big mission is to try and achieve a zero death rate for young people with anaphylaxis, because I think it's possible. You know, accidents will always happen, and there's always going to be some trickiness about accessing the right level of healthcare. But once they're in healthcare, with the advent of good critical care and experts being good at their job and ECMO and all these things that are much more readily available, that actually we can strive for a zero death rate in young people. It gets harder with older people when their physiology is already sort of compromised, but it's something that we can probably improve there as well. But young people don't need to die from anaphylaxis.
I agree with you, and I wish you all the luck with achieving your goal.
Thanks so much, Susie. It's really good to talk with you.
Thanks, Ben. As I said, this episode was a tough one. I have known Ben since medical school. I've worn the same uniform that he wore the day that he had to resuscitate his son. So I didn't examine the events of that day as closely as I know some of you might have liked. If you do want to hear more, and it's very natural to do so, then I suggest you visit the AMAX4 website, which I mentioned at the start, where he does explain things in more detail in one of the video lectures. Ben has also kindly written an article for the September 2023 edition of Australian Anaesthetist, and the draft that I have read is gut-wrenching. In it, he asks us to, and I quote, "Imagine having to be the one to walk around to your child's side because no one else was there and put your finger in your child's cricoid ring, introduce a bougie and intubate them yourself." Yeah, pretty full on. All right, what else? As I mentioned, I do have another podcast on anaphylaxis in the pipeline, so subscribe or follow if you want to be notified of when that one lands.
I've also put a link to the Lollipops Moment TED Talk that we chat about at the start of the podcast in the show notes. It's actually about everyday leadership and creating, sharing, and thanking people for the impact they have on our lives. So thank you to Ben and the McKenzie family. I hope all of us are staying well and safe out there.
Thank you for listening to the Australian Anesthesia Podcast, which can be found on all the major podcast hosting platforms, as well as YouTube. This podcast is produced by the Australian Society of Anaesthetists and hosted by Dr. Susie New, with music created by Dr. Mark Seuss. The ASA was formed in 1934, and our vision is for every anaesthetist in Australia to be at their best, providing the highest quality anaesthesia and perioperative care through excellent technical and non-technical skills. We also hope that this means that you are functioning at your best when you're away from work. In this podcast, we have conversations that seek to inform, challenge, and inspire you to keep you performing at your best. Members of the ASA can access full versions of all episodes by logging into the ASA website at asa.org.au. If you are listening on your favourite podcast app, then make sure you look at the episode notes for the direct link to the podcast on the ASA website. Also, feel free to follow or subscribe so that you can receive the latest episodes as we do publish regularly. If you have any questions or feedback, please feel free to email us on podcast@asa.org.au. Thank you for your time, and we hope you enjoyed listening.